Today we're going to pick up our study with the Book of the Covenant, and I don't know that we will finish. I actually think I promised you last week we would. We're going to see how far we get today in the Book of the Covenant, and I want to begin today's lesson with a short scripture reading from the New Testament, and we'll be looking at a few verses from the beginning of Galatians chapter 5, of course in the context of the law that God is giving to Israel at Mount Sinai. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. Behold, I, Paul, say to you that if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. And I testify again to every man who receives circumcision that he is under obligation to keep the whole law. You've been severed from Christ, you who are seeking to be justified by the law. You've fallen from grace. For we through the Spirit by faith are waiting for the hope of righteousness. For in Christ Jesus neither circumcision nor uncircumcision means anything, but faith working through love. We've been looking at some of the laws recorded in the Book of the Covenant. As I've told you, these are laws that in and of themselves are not applicable to us today. We are not bound to keep these laws. This is the point that Paul is making in those verses we read in Galatians. And my challenge as your teacher is to find a way to take laws that have no bearing whatsoever on us today in terms of our being under the law and make those relevant and interesting. So we'll see how that goes as we go through this. Now, this will not be our beginning point with this Book of the Covenant. We've looked already at laws regarding treatment of male slaves. We've looked at laws that define the treatment of female slaves. And we've looked at some capital crimes, some of which are premeditated murder, kidnapping with the intent of possessing or selling a human being by force. And we have seen also that dishonoring a parent, either by striking the parent or by cursing or failing to honor the parent, was under the Mosaic law a capital offense. With that as the background for where we've looked, today we're going to see that the text moves to laws pertaining to bodily injury. So let's read a few of these verses beginning in Exodus chapter 21. And we'll begin reading with verse 18 and I'll read through verse 27. If men have a quarrel, so that's the context, two men are having a quarrel, and if one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die, but remains in bed, if he gets up and walks around outside on his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished. He shall only pay for his loss of time and shall take care of him until he's completely healed. If a man strikes a male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. If, however, he survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child, so that she has a miscarriage, yet there's no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there's any further injury, then you shall appoint as penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, he shall let that slave go free on account of his eye. And if he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, he shall not let him go free, or he shall let him go free on account of his tooth. So the issue at hand here is an assault that occurs, resulting in bodily injury, but not death. The penalty for injuring another person in a fight under the Mosaic law is monetary in nature. Compensating for loss of productivity and for any attendant medical bills is the responsibility of the guilty party under the law. And since the sanction is monetary in nature, there's no distinction made in the law, in this section of the law at least, between one who strikes with intent and one who strikes accidentally. The penalty is the same in both cases, full restitution. So whereas the motive was an issue with regard to killing a person, if the result of the attack is bodily injury and not death, then motive was not part of the consideration, at least here in this portion of the law. The text moves then to laws pertaining to slaves in this regard. Verses 20 and 21 give the punishments that are laid out under the law for violence against slaves. And when we read this, it's sort of natural, I think, for us to think, well, obviously, anyone who injures or kills his slave should be held responsible. But what we have to understand about the Mosaic legislation, and really when we're studying the Old Testament, is that the information that God reveals to Israel in the Old Testament is designed for them in a particular religious context, and it's also designed for them to live as a nation in a particular legal context. And what is significant about this part of the Mosaic Law is that if it is taking some rather harsh legal codes that were in place at this time in the history, and it is really upgrading those and elevating the value of the human being. And I'm going to try to show you how that occurs in certain parts of our lesson today. What's significant here is that if a man kills a slave, the one thing that I saw here that looks like a new addition to me as I've looked at some of these other codes is that it elevates the slave to the point where the principle laid out in verse 12 of this chapter applies. You'll recall from last week, verse 12 says, "He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death." Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. In this context, I believe this also applies if the victim is a slave. And I'm assuming this because in verse 12, the Hebrew term that's used there and translated "shall be punished" is the word nakam. And it's translated, "he shall be punished," but if you look at that word in the context of the Old Testament, it's a very strong word, and it means to suffer vengeance. And it's written there that if a person kills his slave, then he shall be the recipient of what would be a great vengeance. And it's written in a certain way in the Hebrew text. It literally says, "suffering vengeance, he shall suffer vengeance." So it's actually written two times, and that intensifies the meaning of the word. It appears that no distinction is made in the valuing of the lives of a slave versus a free man. That is a great innovation in the legal code of the Old Testament. A slave, according to the Old Testament, is created in the image of God, exactly as the slave owner or as any free man. And the life of that slave is protected under the same basis. This was not the case in the law codes that predated Moses. The slave was considered chattel, and if a free man killed a slave, the slave owner was recompensed monetarily. The focus was on the slave's owner's monetary loss, not on the life of the slaves. If you look through Sumerian laws, the Code of Hammurabi, and many of these legal codes that were in place there, you'll find in this context that the law is written to focus on the monetary loss of the slave owner and not on the value of the life of the slave. So this is a great innovation that the Mosaic Law brings into the legal context into which Israel would be living after the contest. The Mosaic Law elevates the status of a slave to that is virtually equal to the status of any free man. Verses 22 through 27 deal with incidents that may occur injuring a pregnant woman. It doesn't distinguish here whether this pregnant woman is slave or free. What we find is that there is in the Pentateuch no law governing cases where a person strikes a pregnant woman willfully. Now, at first, that might seem interesting. It says in verse 22 that if a man struggles with another man and strikes a woman with child so that she miscarries, and then it continues on there. But there is nothing that deals in the Pentateuch with what happens if he strikes her intentionally. And really, there's no need to. Because if she or the child dies, you have the dictate of verse 12, any man who strikes another man so that he dies shall be put to death. That would apply. And then if it's bodily injury that's incurred, we have also in verses 18 and 19 things that are applicable to that situation. So there's really no need to single out the intentional. That's already been covered with other legislation. I think this is supported by verse 23 that says, if there's further injury, then you shall appoint penalty life for life. So if in this quarrel the woman is injured, she dies, the principle of life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, bruise for bruise applies. And we already have that in other sections of this legislation. I take the phrase, so that she gives birth prematurely, simply to mean that she gives birth to a viable infant who survives. And I understand the phrase, but if there's further injury, to mean if the woman or the child dies or is seriously injured. One of the words that's used here to refer to this injury is translated, I believe, in the AV, mischief. It's translated injury in the NIV and NASB, and it's the term assown, and it means serious injury or harm. But since the penalty is conceivably life for life, then I think it has to cover the possibility that she was killed. So if there's injury but no death, if she and the child live but there's injury, then the sanctions of 21 verses 18 and 19 would govern that situation, namely that the guilty party would be responsible for her care and for any medical bills that are incurred due to the injury. Now, only the case of an unintentional injury is given here in order to set the stage for entering some new protections into the law that were not available under prevailing law codes. There are several of these, among which are all human beings are created equal, irrespective of social class, and there's no differentiation made when administering justice under the Mosaic Law on behalf of this injured woman. Another is that sanctions are to be executed only against the man who caused the injury. His daughter or wife, if he happens to have one, are not to be harmed as part of the retribution for the injury to the woman. Under Mesopotamian law that was current at the time this was written, the wife or daughter of the guilty man could be taken and punished as retribution against the man in sort of a perverted eye for eye, or in this case, daughter for daughter principle. I thought you might like to actually hear what some of these laws sounded like, so I just happened to have my pocket copy of the Code of Hammurabi. I thought I'd read a little bit of it to you. If a free man strikes another man or another man's daughter and has caused her to have a miscarriage, he shall pay 10 shekels of silver for her fetus. If that woman has died, they shall put his daughter to death. How would you like to be a young girl in the ancient Near East? The man strikes your daughter. She dies. The law says, then we'll go kill your daughter. If by a blow he has caused a commoner's daughter to have a miscarriage, he shall pay 5 shekels of silver. If that woman has died, he shall pay 1/2 mina of silver. Here you see that the life of the slave under the Code of Hammurabi was indeed not elevated to a point of equality with the life of the slave owner or a free man. So we see that distinction in social class in this code. If he struck a free man's female slave and has caused her to have a miscarriage, he shall pay 2 shekels of silver. If that female slave has died, he shall pay 1/3 of a mina of silver. This is what the law codes were like when the Mosaic Law came into play. Keep in mind, this is a tribal culture. So enforcement of law many times fell to the next of kin. And we're going to see here in a moment another advancement that the Mosaic Law brings to the table. Is it says when certain things happen, we're going to bring this case before the judges. You remember the Mishpatim. This goes way back to when Moses' father-in-law met, and Moses is trying to judge all of the practical issues of the day with the people, and his father-in-law says, you're not going to be able to do this. You need to appoint wise men who are good judges and let them handle many of these issues. So we don't know exactly what that system looked like, but there were judges in place, and you'll see references to them as we go through this a bit. As far as how it happened in Babylon under Hammurabi, I don't really know the answer to that. But I want to point out that under this Code of Hammurabi, the daughter of the offending party could be killed in a daughter-for-daughter exchange. The victim was probably killed by the next of kin, although it doesn't lay that out specifically either. I think it's also important to notice that under the Code of Hammurabi, the penalty for killing a female slave is financial. It's not life for life. This clearly indicates that In Hammurabi's code, the life of a slave girl was considered inferior to the life of the slave owner and even to the life of the murderer himself. So this is what I mean by having to look at these things in a context. The Old Testament was not written in a vacuum. It was written in a historical, cultural context where there were certain religious ideas, certain theological ideas that were in play, and certain legal and judicial laws that were in play. And we have, the more we know about those things, the better we're able to evaluate and understand what is written in the Old Testament. Another advancement is that under the Mosaic system, the penalties that were executed against guilty parties were determined and rendered according to Torah principles, and they were administered by judges who stood between the guilty party and the family of the injured woman. We're seeing here, at least in part, a bit of a stepping away from tribal justice that was prevalent in this particular day. As I warned you early on, we're not trying to cover every detail of every law, so I want to move on to verses 28 through 36. Verse 22 is the crux interpretum, I think, for a lot of people in the abortion question. The difficulty with it, from a purely objective point of view, is who was injured. It's not clear in the English text, nor is it clear in the Hebrew text, whether the injury refers back to an injury to the pregnant woman or whether it refers back to the injury of the fetus. I'll tell you how I tend to look at it, and this may not be the most technical exegesis of the text, but I think it refers to both or either one. That's my thought about it. So that what this does is it creates a basis for understanding a value for the life of the unborn child. Can you make a complete doctrine for your position on abortion from this single verse? Probably not just from this verse, but it is quite supportive of that, in my opinion. So let's look beginning here with verse 28 through 36. I have to tell you, you got to keep your eyes on an ox in the Old Testament. You can get in trouble real quickly if you own an ox. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall surely be stoned and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall go unpunished. However, if an ox was previously in the habit of goring, and its owner has not confined it, and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner shall be put to death. If a ransom is demanded of him, then he shall give for the redemption of his life whatever is demanded. Whether it gores a son or a daughter, it shall be done to him according to the same rule. If the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. If a man opens a pit, he digs a hole, he digs a pit. If he opens a pit or digs a pit and does not cover it over and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead animal shall become his. If one man's ox hurts another man's ox so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide its price equally, and also they shall divide the dead ox. Or if it's known that the ox was previously in the habit of goring, yet its owner has not confined it, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall become his. If you haven't figured this out yet, in ancient Near Eastern law codes, the ox was used as a typical example of damage caused by domestic animals. And it's all through the Code of Hammurabi and codes in Sumeria as well. It's the kind of poster child for potential problems. I think the law, and the point I want to make about this whole section, is that the law distinguishes between accident and negligence. And it treats the two differently. If an ox who's not accustomed to goring kills a man, responsibility is borne solely by the ox. If the ox is known for goring, it's done this before, then guilt lies with the owner of the ox. A person, an ox owner in this case, is not exempted from responsibility when the damage is a result of negligence. However, the law, we'll see in other places, does allow for circumstances that are beyond the control of the ox owner. Let's look at chapter 22, verses 1 through 4. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. If the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account. But if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. He shall surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. If what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, whether it's an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. The Torah cites these laws about theft to counter the legal traditions reflected in the Code of Hammurabi. At this time in the ancient Near East, the penalty for theft was death if the thief could not repay the victim for its crime. Back to the Code of Hammurabi for a moment. Let me just read you a couple of examples here. If a free man stole either an ox or a sheep or a donkey or a pig or a boat, how they came up with those specific things, I don't know. And if it belonged to the temple or if it belonged to the state, he shall make 30-fold restitution. So if you stole an ox that belonged to the temple, you had to repay 30 oxen. If you stole a boat that belonged to the state, you had to provide back in recompense 30 boats. If it belonged to a private citizen, the thief shall make good 10-fold. So it's a worse crime in Babylon to steal from the temple or the state than it is to steal from a private citizen. Now listen to this. If the thief does not have sufficient funds to make restitution, he shall be put to death. Now there's a rather lengthy scenario that he begins to outline here where a thief steals something and then he goes out and he sells it to someone who knowingly buys stolen property. So without reading all of that to you, let me just get to the key here. It says, since the seller, in this case, was the thief, he shall be put to death. Then it skips down and it's talking about the person who bought the stolen property. The purchaser is a thief because he bought the stolen property. He shall be put to death. Then it moves to robbery. If a free man committed robbery and he's caught, the free man shall be put to death. So under these ancient Near Eastern laws, the penalty for theft was loss of life. Hammurabi codified this tradition, this putting to death of a thief, and it was against his interpretation of that harsh penalty and against this tradition in the ancient Near East that the Torah elevates the value of human life. In the Torah, we see that the law of Moses cancels the death penalty for theft, and in so doing recognizes the sanctity of life, even the life of a thief. However, if a thief breaks into a house in the night because of the potential threat of loss of life to his potential victim, lethal force was able to be used against him, and there was no blood guiltiness that would be assessed against the homeowner if he kills the thief in what would be interpreted under the Mosaic law as self-defense. That's verses 2 and 3 of Exodus chapter 22. But I think this is important. The potential threat to life, to the life of the homeowner, is the thing that elevates this nighttime break-in to a level that justifies use of lethal force. It's not the simple act of protecting property. There are remedies for recovering stolen property. There is no remedy for recovering a life that has been taken. If this occurs at night, and in fact this is still reflected in our laws today, this court will look at circumstances that say if it was dark and you could not know for certain that your life or the life of your family was not in danger, then you have a higher level of justification for using lethal force than you would if it happened in your backyard in the daytime. And this goes all the way back to these verses in Exodus chapter 22. So let me sum this up regarding theft. Theft is the breaking of the eighth commandment, and it violates the biblical principle of private ownership of property. Sanctions range from justifiable homicide if the thief breaks in at night to repayment of the stolen property. And we'll also see that recovery of stolen property reduces the severity of the penalty. Verses 5 and 6. If a man lets a field or vineyard be grazed bare and lets his animal loose so that it grazes in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. If the fire breaks out and spreads to the thorn bushes, these thorn bushes would have surrounded probably harvested grain. So the stacked grain or the standing grain of the field itself is consumed. He who started the fire shall make restitution. I'm just going to comment briefly that really the guilty party here, the restitution is he repays the injured party for his losses. Verse 7. If a man gives his neighbor money or goods to keep for him and it's stolen from the man's house, if the thief is caught, he shall pay double. If the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the judges to determine whether he laid his hands on his neighbor's property. For every breach of trust, whether it's for ox or donkey or for sheep, for clothing, or for anything about which one says, "This is it," the case of both parties shall come before the judges. He whom the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. If a man gives his neighbor a donkey or ox or sheep or any animal to keep for him and it dies or it's hurt or it's driven away while no one's looking, an oath before the Lord shall be made by the two of them that he has not laid hands on his neighbor's property, and his owner shall accept it, and he shall not make restitution. But if it's actually stolen from him, he shall make restitution to the owner. If it's torn to pieces, in other words, killed by another animal, if it's torn to pieces, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn to pieces. If a man borrows anything from his neighbor, well, this might apply. I've told you none of this applies to us. This might. If a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it's injured or dies while the owner's not with it, he shall make full restitution. However, if the owner is with it, he shall not make restitution. It came with its hire. So circumstances did play a role in how the Mosaic Law was administered. In cases of breach of trust, the case would be brought before judges, and the case would be decided on the merits of each side as the judges see fit as wise, and keep in mind these are supposed to be wise men who would make good decisions on behalf of all parties concerned. Verse 16, if a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her to be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins. I think we have a clear example here, and really in many of the things that we just read rather quickly here, that the Book of the Covenant was not designed to resolve every potential problem that will be faced by every Israelite in the land of Israel. Life's far too complex for there to be a written solution to every dilemma that people face. I think this is a good example of this. If you look at verse 16, the example given here is a girl who is seduced but who is not engaged. We can presume that if the law were written about a girl who is engaged, perhaps the sanctions would be different. Furthermore, the term seduced is used. If this occurred against the will of the woman, likewise, I believe the sanctions would be quite different. But neither of those other variations is recorded here in the law. So the law is written to allow for wise interpretation regarding many points, and yet on other points it speaks very clearly and very definitively. You start seeing people offering sacrifices in the Old Testament before you find any definition of what the sacrifice is supposed to be or what the altar is supposed to look like or how you're supposed to do it. So many of these things were already in play. I think the same is true about the Code of Hammurabi. I think people were living under a certain group of rules that they had agreed upon, and Hammurabi codified it. That's what I meant when I said he codified these. Maybe you take the best of this tribe and the best of this tribe, and you eliminate the worst of this tribe, and you codify a law then that applies to both tribes. And I think to a certain extent that's the case. We saw this because there was mention of the observance of the Sabbath in chapters in Exodus before the giving of the law. So there was already some sort of Sabbath observance that was occurring in Israel. What the law did then is it said, okay, here's what we want you to do and why. It's codified. It's put into a written form that can be read and interpreted. The other value of doing that is it keeps the judges from having to deal with every single case. People can know what the law is that's written without having to have a judge or a court or a decision maker or a mediator tell them what right and wrong is. Chapter 22, verse 18. You shall not allow a sorceress to live. Whoever lies with an animal shall be put to death. He who sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be utterly destroyed. The word that's translated sorceress here really means one who practices witchcraft. It's written in the feminine gender here in this text, and that's why your Bibles translate this sorceress. I think the same could be presumed about a sorcerer. This is the same word that occurs back in chapter 7 that refers to the advisors of Pharaoh in the staff to serpent episode that we saw there. It's the same exact word, but there it's written in the masculine gender, referring to men. So I think there's nothing particular here about the fact that this is feminine. This would refer to any person who is a practicer of witchcraft. The fundamental theological issue that underlies this prohibition is this. The laws of nature were established by the Creator, and it's impossible for a human being to change them, and it's certainly impossible for a human being to force God to act in His creation against His will. This is why the Torah opposes all forms of magic. The reason magic and sorcery is wrong in the Old Testament is it's a challenge to the sovereignty of God. It's a challenge to the decisions that God made at creation and the patterns that He laid down. And it presumes that man can control the deity. That's why the Torah is opposed to all forms of magic and why here this is considered a capital offense. Many times in the Bible, sorcery and idolatry are linked. And it is here as well, at least in terms of the proximity of verse 18 to verse 20. Verse 21. You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you afflict him at all, and if he cries out to me, I'll hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled, and I'll kill you with the sword. And your wives shall become widows, and your children will become orphans. So God's saying, if you oppress the widow and the orphan, then think about your own wife. Think about your own children. I'll make your wife a widow, and I'll make your children fatherless. Verse 25. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you're not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you're to return it to him before the sun sets, for this is his only covering. It's his cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? And it shall come about that when he cries out to me, I'll hear him, for I'm gracious. These are laws concerning the poor and the needy. Israel is commanded not to mistreat strangers or widows or orphans based on their own experiences in Egypt. In Egypt, the Israelites were strangers. They were strangers in a foreign land. So they knew from experience the difficulty that this imposes on a person. The very nature of slavery itself, in the sense that they encountered it in Egypt, would have produced many a widow and many an orphan. The only additional comment I'm going to make here is that throughout the Old Testament, two of the main reasons God brings judgment against Israel are involvement with idolatry and mistreatment of the poor and the disadvantaged. Verse 28. You shall not curse God, nor curse a ruler of your people. You shall not delay the offering from your harvest and your vintage. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen and your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days, and on the eighth day you shall give it to me. You shall be holy men to me. Therefore you should not eat any flesh torn to pieces in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. Here we have laws pertaining to God and community leaders. The law proscribed, that is, forbade cursing God, and it forbade cursing leaders, presumably because of disagreement with their policy. And though this law does not directly apply to us today, The Board of Elders hopes that you will honor the spirit of the law when you consider some of the decisions that we make. Israel's leaders were considered God's earthly representatives, and God is presented in Scripture as always in control of the governments he establishes, and he sustains them, and he takes them down according to his will. And I would remind us all that a bad leader can be just as much part of God's plan as a good leader. The law prescribed offerings and sacrifices that were to be offered on time. This included offering of the firstborn of the animals, the fruit of the harvest. It included the redemption of the firstborn male child. And you may recall that we studied this idea of God having a claim on the firstborn, both man and beast, back in chapter 13, verses 2 and then 11 through 16. The context there was that when the Lord brings you into the land of Canaan that he swore to your fathers. It's an interesting statement because it's a link back to the Abrahamic covenant. But there's also a forward-looking context here because it mentions the conquest of Canaan and it pictures Israel as being ensconced in the land of promise. God told Israel to sanctify the firstborn in chapter 13, verse 2, and to devote the firstborn in chapter 13, verse 12. The devoting of the firstborn means to give over. The Hebrew term there implies the transfer of ownership. That the transfer of ownership from the firstborn of beast and the firstborn of the family, the first male child, is transferred over to the ownership of God. So God considered the firstborn males of both man and beast to be his holy possession and set apart and transferred to him by the people. For the animals, this meant that the animal was sacrificed. For the firstborn male in the family, that meant that he was redeemed for a price. He was bought with a price, but obviously not sacrificed. Okay, God has said the firstborn, I think the way it said it back in chapter 13, the first male to break the womb is mine. So God has declared his ownership of the firstborn lamb, male lamb, the firstborn human being. They're mine. If you have a donkey that has a male donkey, then you could redeem, you could make a choice at this point. You could either take that donkey on its eighth day and kill it by breaking its neck. But if you didn't want to do that, if you wanted to keep the donkey, you could take a sheep, which had a lower monetary value than a donkey, and you could sacrifice the sheep to God in place of the donkey. That's what we mean by redeemed. The donkey then in that context is redeemed. You didn't have to kill it, you redeemed it by sacrificing a sheep. Obviously, God never intends for a family to sacrifice the child. That's never in God's intent at all. There's a process put in place where the family would redeem the child through the sacrifice of a substitutionary animal in his place. Redeemed means to purchase. Chapter 23, look at the first 9 verses here. You shall not bear a false report. Do not join hands with the wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil. That's a good one to teach your kids, by the way. Nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in a dispute. Isn't that interesting? If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him, and you shall surely release him with it. In other words, help the animal. You shall not pervert the justice due to your needy brother in a dispute. Keep far from a false charge and do not kill the innocent or the righteous, for I will not acquit the guilty. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. You shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourself know the feelings of a stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. So this starts out by saying you shall not bear a false report. What commandment stands behind that piece of applied law? Yeah, commandment number 9. I think verse 3 is interesting. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in a dispute. I think we're kind of conditioned in our society today to think that the underdog deserves a slight edge. But the law always has in mind a fundamental sense of justice that's not based on social class. Certainly the rich man is never to be favored above the poor man. But neither is the poor man to be exalted above the rich when justice is in view. The law is not an excuse, this law is not an excuse not to help the downtrodden. But what's in view here is justice and not charity. That's the distinction that we have to make in our understanding of this verse. What is in view here is justice and not charity. It's the commitment to pure justice that elevates the Torah above these other law codes. Equal justice is due every man, whether that man is rich or whether he is poor. And what I find interesting about this is that it establishes a right and wrong that transcends the details of life. It's a justice that is grounded in the justice of God's character and not in man's circumstances. Listen to what is written over in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 15. It's even more clear here. You shall do no injustice in judgment. In other words, we're looking here for a justice and a judgment in human history that reflects the character of God. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor shall you defer to the great, but you're to judge your neighbor fairly. What a concept. We should separate in our minds charity from justice. We should certainly be for charity. I'm for it. But I'm also for justice. And the two are different. The way to understand this is to understand the difference in charity. And I mean that in a good way. The expression of love toward others, toward the orphan, toward the widow, toward the underprivileged. But not to pervert justice in the process. Carlton said is that justice presumes the application of force, whereas charity presumes the application of love. That's a good way to look at this. Thank you for that. I may need some help from our Dallas Seminary professor over here. For me, I understand that relationship to be going back to the pattern set in creation and the fact that Adam was the federal head of the race and he was the head of Eve. And so God deals with the human race primarily through males. There's actually kind of a break at this point, because up until this point in the Book of the Covenant, the precepts and the edicts have been more or less general principles that are valid at all times and in all seasons. But now we're going to come to a point where we get into a section of the Book of the Covenant where the dicta are to be observed according to specific times. In other words, what follows are some laws that apply to seasons that are dedicated specifically to the service of the Lord and therefore are part of Israel's prescribed worship. Chapter 23, beginning with verse 10. You shall sow your land for 6 years and gather in its yield. But on the seventh year, you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat. And whatever they leave, the beast of the field may eat. You're to do the same with your vineyard and with your olive grove. 6 days you're to do your work, but on the seventh day you're to cease from labor in order that your ox and your donkey may rest, and the son of your female slave as well as your stranger may refresh themselves. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read just a few verses out of the 25th chapter of Leviticus, which deal with this same thing. And I think it'll clarify the meaning of the Exodus passage. This is Leviticus chapter 25, verse 1. The Lord then spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord." Notice what he says. The land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. And what is that Sabbath? He defines it in verse 3. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its crops. But during the seventh year the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. Your harvest after growth you shall not reap, and your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. All of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food, yourself and your male and female slaves, and your hired man and your foreign resident, those who live as aliens with you, even your cattle and the animals that are in your land shall have all of its crops to eat. This is the first of the law that pertains to the seventh year and the seventh day. And I think we could paraphrase these two passages by saying that although you shall work your fields and harvest your crops for 6 years, you shall not do so in the seventh year. In year seven, you're to let the land rest. You're to leave it to itself. Moreover, you're to allow the poor to eat the produce of the land and animals to eat the produce of the land. The crops will not be considered your private property. Anything that grows there will be considered ownerless, so that those who have no inheritance, the beasts of the field, who are also God's creatures, can share in God's bounty. What God is saying here is that rich or poor, you're going to have to trust me to provide. And I'm going to remind you of that every 7 years. He's already reminding them of that on a smaller scale every 7 days. Now he says, I'm going to remind you in a big way every 7 years. There are at least a couple of parallels I can think of to what we're reading here. Can anybody think of any parallels that we've seen in Exodus that sort of paralleled this idea? Well, what about the manna? God provided for the people in the wilderness when they could not and where they could not provide for themselves by giving them manna for 6 days. They had to trust him that on the sixth day he would provide enough manna to sustain them through the sixth and the seventh day. But if they tried to gather extra on days 1 through 5, it turned to maggots. I think that's a parallel. When we looked at the rules regarding male slaves, they work for 6 years. And then they're released as free men without redemption. And we obviously have the institution of the Sabbath. There's something very important about this rule, about this law. And it's this. Israel's failure to keep this law was one of the primary reasons for the Babylonian captivity. Sometimes it's not easy to find cause-effect relationships in life. And this is certainly not the only reason Israel went into captivity. But it is cited in Scripture as one of the main reasons. Let me read a little bit to you from Leviticus chapter 26, beginning with verse 32. I will make the land desolate so that your enemies who settle in it shall be appalled over it. You, however, I'll scatter among the nations and will draw out a sword after you as your land becomes desolate and your cities become waste. Then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation while you are in your enemy's land. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation it will observe the rest which it did not observe on your Sabbaths when you were living in it. And quickly over in 2 Chronicles, listen to what he says. The wrath of the Lord arose against his people until there was no remedy. Therefore he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion on young man or virgin, old man or infirm. He gave them all into his hand. All the articles of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his officers, he brought them all to Babylon. Then they burned the house of God and broke down the wall of Jerusalem, and burned all of its fortified buildings with fire and destroyed all of its valuable articles. Those who had escaped from the sword he carried away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and to his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia. To fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths, all the days of its desolation it kept Sabbath until the 70 years were complete. The 70 years of captivity in Babylon made up for the 490 years that Israel failed to keep this little law in the book of Moses. I think we're going to stop here, since I didn't realize I've been talking over an hour.